history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to a special Veterans Day edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, you better believe there are heroes around you, and we have the privilege of meeting them each week here on the radio. According to the VA, there are roughly 20 million veterans living in America today. Only about 600,000 of them now represent that World War II generation that we hear from each week. I trust you're taking time out to say thank you to all the veterans you know this weekend. And chances are, you have members of your own family who've served in our armed forces. In my case, I get to thank my mother for the time she spent as an Army nurse, my uncle for his years as an Air Force pilot. I reflect on my late grandfather, a decorated Army doctor, whose story inspired my work with World War II veterans. His brother was wounded in Germany during World War II, and their uncle was a pioneering pilot who died in his airplane in World War I. I'm very proud of the legacy of service in my family, but I'm wondering, do the veterans in your family know how proud you are of them? Veterans Day is your opportunity to make sure they do, and in preparing for this week's show, reflecting on some of the incredible stories we've been fortunate enough to hear this year, I realized we very rarely have the chance to go back and share updates, encouraging developments that have occurred in these veterans' lives after we've had the privilege of meeting them here. So that's what's on the agenda today. We're going to hear some snippets from their original interviews, and remember, you can always find those in their entirety at hometownheroesradio.com. But then in each case, we'll have something new to tell you about, honors they've received, questions that were still unanswered at the time of the interview but have since been settled. You get the idea. And we're going to start with a man who was there when World War II began for America. Nebraska native Don Stratton, now living in Colorado Springs, Colorado, was aboard the USS Arizona on the morning of December 7th, 1941.
My battle station was a sight setter in the port anti-aircraft guns on the port side, and that was up about 55, 60 feet in the air on a tripod mast on the foremast.
And people hear you say that, and maybe some of them have already read your book, All the Gallant Men, or they've seen one of your interviews or heard you before. They saw you at Pearl on the 75th anniversary. But when people imagine that morning and they think about you being in that position, that many feet in the air with these Japanese planes coming in and bombs dropping, I'm sure they say, how in the world did you survive? You ever wonder that yourself?
Well, it had to be a lot of to do with the good Lord, I guess. But we were kind of trapped up there. We got out of the director and on the deck there, and the vessel was alongside a repair ship, and we got a hold of a seaman there that threw us a heaving line with that's a line with a lead on the end to stretch it out, and a small line, and then he added a big, heavier line, and we pulled that across, and we tied it off on the Arizona, and we started hand over hand across it, and we were already burnt. I was burnt like over 60% of my body, I guess, at that time.
How did that occur? You were in that position on the foremast when the big explosion happened?
The bomb that hit on the starboard side behind number two turret went into a million pounds of ammunition and it blew up. That just was a fireball that just engulfed us up there where we were at, and no way to escape or get off. So until we got the line there to go hand over hand across, we were kind of just stymied up there, and we finally got off. Six of us went across there, and only two of us alive today.
Yeah, I know you're not into getting all syrupy and sappy, but I'm just trying to imagine what those moments were like when you're engulfed in flames and your flesh is burning and you're trapped and you can't go anywhere. What do you do?
You're just trying to get out away from the flames and thinking about how the hell am I going to get out of here.
So if that seaman hadn't had that idea to tie that line.
Well, we kind of indicated that we wanted to get off of there, and he throwed us a heaving line, which is a small line, and then tied on the heavier line, and it's about probably 65, 70 feet across there, and we had to go hand over hand across there.
So already you said 60%+ of your body had been burned. So is that upper body, lower body?
Well, the whole body, everything.
But your hands were okay?
My hands were burnt I don't even have any fingerprints.
Well, was that from the explosion or was that from going down that line?
That was both.
So your hands are burnt, and then you have to hold on to a line or else you're going to fall to your death.
Right.
With hands that are already burnt, and I can't imagine what that feels like, the pain that you must have been experiencing. Or did the adrenaline take over?
Well, it's just self-preservation.
So you get down to that other ship, the Vestal, which is next to the Arizona. I've interviewed a couple guys who were on that ship, and they've described what your ship looked like. But once you got aboard on the Vestal, there's still a lot going on, probably. What did you see from there?
Well, we stood around there for quite a while. The Vestal was busy with firing their guns and whatever and trying to get away from the side of the Arizona and the explosion. And they finally got us in the shore boat and took us to the beach, and they picked us up in an open-air truck and took us to the hospital.
And how long were you in the hospital?
A year.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. Wasn't quite that long. It was like till the next September.
And I'm sure, well, I've read some of your story. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I want to understand how you experienced it. So very few people alive experienced what you experienced. You're in all this pain, and you know you're going to recover. But was it a daily basis in those days that followed that you were learning of other guys that you knew from the ship who didn't make it?
Well, we most certainly figured that, but there was a few ex-sailors in the hospital with us and everything, so but we knew we'd suffered a devastating hit in a lot of casualties, but it took a lot of baths, saltwater baths, and a lot of healing and a lot of patience.
Yeah, where did that come from? You're a pretty young guy. You haven't been through a whole lot until this.
Well, you do what you have to do.
Did your parents know you were alive, or did that take a while?
No, they got a notice that I didn't make it, and then they got a notice that I did. But they sent us back to Mare Island Hospital and went through a lot of baths, a lot of skin grafts, a lot of time laying. They put us on a bunk and put a canopy over the top of us and covered the canopy with a blanket and put light bulbs in the canopy to keep us warm. Kept the burns open to the healing air. I wanted to go back into the Navy, so I went back after I was home for about a year, and my whole left side healed up really much from the medical discharge. So I re-enlisted and went back in, and they put me on I went to boot camp again because I hadn't caught up on my shots and stuff, and I went to island there in the bay, and they put me aboard a destroyer, DD-406 USS Stack. We headed for the South Pacific right away, and we were in on the invasion of the whole land in New Guinea and a couple of islands offshore there. And we went to Guadalcanal, picked up troops to put in the Philippines, and the lady, and we were in the Battle of Leyte Gulf, and we were in the Battle of Luzon Gulf, and we led all the invasions in with the minesweeps, and finally Okinawa, and we were on pick of a patrol 300 miles north of Okinawa between there and Japan, and for the kamikazes coming down, and let them know down below that they were on their way, and that was kind of hazardous. We lost 5 ships one night there, and they sent me back to the States, and the war was over, and I had a game.
And I understand that you lived that, and that you've told your story many times. So that is, in a way, old hat to you. But you do understand how crazy that sounds to most people, right? That you were burned over the majority of your body. You still don't have any feeling in your fingers that you haven't had for 75 years. You're recovering for a year in the hospital. You've been medically discharged. But you sign up to go back, and you end up fighting the rest of the war. Why? Why was that so important to you?
Well, it's just one of those things that happens, I guess. Felt like maybe I should be there, whatever happened, but that's the way it worked.
And the title of your book is All the Gallant Men, and you're honoring those who died December 7th and really the 406,000 Americans who died in the war. But it strikes me that just that action you took, I mean, you are the gallant man. Did you feel that you were doing something beyond what was asked of you?
No, the heroes were still out there.
Still on your ship.
Yeah.
What'd your parents think when you re-enlisted?
Well, actually, they didn't want me to go, but they said, if that's what you're made up your mind to do, it's your life to live. It's just the thing that surprise attacked and didn't get a chance to fight back too much, so was still in the same predicament. I loved the Navy, and I went back in.
Well, I'm sure you've heard a lot of people say a lot of things to you over the years, but I've interviewed close to 1,000 World War II veterans and many courageous, incredible men who blow me away with their stories. But just your story and what you just shared and your determination, that's really remarkable, sir.
Well, like I tell everybody, everybody had to be someplace.
Yeah.
And I was there.
Yes, he was. And we're thankful he's still with us today. Remember, you can pull up that entire interview at hometownheroesradio.com. But the update has to do with where Don Stratton was months after our interview. On July 21st of this year, this American hero visited our nation's capital for the very first time. And it wasn't a sightseeing trip, though he did take his wife of 67 years, Velma, along. Don and two other USS Arizona survivors accepted an invitation to the White House so they could push for a medal for Joe George, that sailor from the Vestal who tossed the rope and saved the lives of Don and other sailors that day. So I'm pretty sure you'll recognize this voice in the Oval Office on July 21st.
Lauren Brunner and Donald Stratton are also with us. They were on the deck of the USS Arizona doing their duty when the ship was engulfed by massive, massive flames. They were both fortunate enough to be rescued by another courageous hero, Joe George, whose daughter, Joanne, is with us today. Joe was in a boat next to the USS Arizona, and when he saw several men still standing, he hurled a rope onto the deck of the ship at tremendous risk to himself. Lauren and Don clung to that rope, and hand over hand, they crossed through the 70 feet of flames, burning endlessly. The story of Lauren and Don's devotion and duty doesn't end there. Despite suffering terrible burns, still with them today, they both served in the Navy for years after, fighting in some of the greatest Pacific engagements in World War II. Lauren and Don, thank you very much for your lifetime of service and your lifetime of sacrifice. Thank you very much.
So that, of course, was President Donald Trump in the Oval Office in July, honoring Don Stratton, two other USS Arizona survivors, and the late Joe George, who was never awarded a medal for his life-saving heroics because he disobeyed an order to leave the area. Don didn't get to talk to the president in private, but that brief public exchange does give him hope that the man who saved his life will be officially honored by our government someday. Also, while in Washington, Stratton and his fellow Arizona survivors laid a wreath at Arlington National Cemetery's Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, honoring the 1,177 men who died aboard their ship on December 7th, 1941. Their names, of course, are inscribed in marble at the USS Arizona Memorial at Pearl Harbor, where my travels just so happened to take me this weekend. I visited that hallowed ground with buses full of college football players, none of whom were born until more than 50 years after Pearl Harbor. But now they have a whole new understanding of the price that has been paid for our freedom. The USS Arizona Memorial has been visited by millions and millions. But until a few months ago, there was another of World War II's most famous ships whose wreckage had never been found. The USS Indianapolis was resting on the bottom of the Philippine Sea for more than 72 years until a crew commissioned by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen discovered it in August. In a few moments, you're going to hear the latest development for Adolfo Harpo Celaya, who survived the sinking of the Indianapolis and the tragic shark attacks in the nearly 4 days that followed before survivors were spotted. But first, I want you to hear just a few minutes of what Harpo shared here on Hometown Heroes about July 30th, 1945. The ship had just delivered components of the atomic bomb that would eventually end the war to the island of Tinian and was on its way back when the Indy was attacked by a Japanese submarine.
I had gone to sleep down there below, but I had my crew chief, which came down looking for me and came over and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Why don't we go up on top deck? Our watch goes from 4 to 8. He said, "We can wake each other up." And so I went with him, and there wasn't a place upstairs that you could lay on. It was all the sailors were upstairs because it was very hot. But I remember I always used to sleep with a blanket on. Everybody used to make fun of me because I did that, but I was got used to it, and my crew chief was laughing at when we went to bed, and that's where I was when they repeated it. The big explosion happened right where I was at. The thing that saved me was a blanket that I had on. You because when I woke up, there was no blanket. The fire had taken it off.
Were you burned at all?
I had burns on my legs and my hands were, I had my hands out, but my hair was almost all gone. My eyelashes were gone there then. So it was a pretty good sized blast, and it killed a lot of sailors around me. The only thing that saved me, I think, was the blanket.
Well, this was just 4 days after you guys had gotten to Tinian with that important cargo.
Yeah.
Of course, and you still didn't know what that was. But what a way to wake up with your hair burned off, your eyebrows burned off, the blanket blown off of you. And that ship, this huge cruiser with 1,200 men on board, sunk in just 12 minutes?
12 minutes.
What was that 12 minutes like for you?
Well, I ran to the back of it, and then that's where I met with my friend Santos Peña. I didn't have a life jacket. I didn't have anything with me. In fact, I only had my T-shirt and my shorts. I didn't have shoes. I have nothing. And I told Santos, I got to go down below, Santos, because I don't have a life jacket. And he said, you can't. He said, the ship is going down. I said, I just came from the front of it. He said, the whole front end is gone, he said. So I stayed with him. We both jumped off. When I hit the water, I hit something, and I thought I had hit Santos. And I thought I'd killed him, you know, so I didn't see Santos for 3 days. But after 3 days, we met up with another group, and here he was. I found him there. I saw the shark coming around. I mean, everybody would, when they say sharks, they start kicking and all that stuff. And I kind of stayed in the middle of everything. And when I found Santos Peña, I went around and went over to look for him.
And I imagine the day that you were rescued in August of 1945 has to be the greatest day of your life, because none of the rest of the days would have happened if that day didn't happen. How did they get you out of there, and how great did that feel?
It's kind of a dazed deal. I mean, because they come down with the landing barges to pick you up with a hook, you know, and put you up in the landing barge. And then when they took you right up next to the ship that was going to put you in, which the Bassett Ocean was so rough that the landing barge was going up and down all the time. And so they had to put a kind of a hammock deal, you know, the deal that they put down, put you in there and tie you up, and then they haul you up to the top, you know. So I remember the sailors that took care of me, they were on this Bassett ship. Oh, they did a heck of a job. They gave me a little glass of water, probably about a two swallows, and I told them, no, I said, want more? And no, you can't have it. So little by little, they got me back on.
They knew you couldn't handle that much. And yeah. I have to imagine you hadn't had anything to eat or drink for more than 3 days, right?
Oh, 4 days. Well, all the time I was there, I never had anything to eat or to drink.
So I imagine there had to be plenty of moments where you thought you were going to die.
I thought so.
How did you keep hope alive? I mean, were you out there praying? Were you trying to talk to other people?
Everybody was praying. I had them here in San Jose. My mother had gotten me a St. Anthony medal.
Mm-hmm.
And that medal that she gave me, I put it in my mouth. That metal stay in my mouth all the time. I can remember that.
I want to get a sense of how tough it was for you to recover, because when your body goes through something like that, it does take a while to recover from those extreme circumstances. How long did it take you to get back to health?
About 4 months, three or four. I spent 3 months in Long Beach Naval Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays they call it something else, post in terms of whatever.
Post-traumatic stress disorder?
In those days, they called you, they said you were crazy or something like that, you know. they didn't bring up this the way they put it up now, you know.
Well, and if you heard Harpo's entire interview, and you can pull that up at hometownheroesradio.com, you know that he did struggle for quite a while to deal with the haunting effects of PTSD and what he had been through. You also know he returned to high school in his hometown of Florence, Arizona. He even led that school to an improbable upset in the state basketball tournament and was named the MVP when they won it all. And Florence, Arizona is where the latest development in Harpo's story unfolded in September of this year, when the post office in his hometown town, thanks to an act of Congress, was officially named the Adolfo Harpo Celaya Post Office. It's time for our first break, but when this special Veterans Day edition of Hometown Heroes continues, more updates to some of the most captivating stories our veterans shared with us this year. An Army nurse, a wounded infantryman, and an ex-prisoner of war are among the voices still to come. Make sure you thank the veterans in your life today, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.